Sometime around 40,000 years ago, some clever human invented this sound. In order to bring those beautiful notes into existence, somebody had to blow into a hollow bone to hear the sound it made. Maybe they tried that with lots of different bones, including one that happened to have a hole in the side. Our innovator would have noticed that bone made a different sound depending on whether they left the hole open or covered it with a finger. Some people might have left it at that, but our ancient musical prodigy had the sort of mind that couldn't let stuff go. Next, they would have wondered, could they produce more sounds if they added more holes and opened and closed them one at a time, in combination? Did it matter where they were placed along the body of the flute? We don't know how long it took, but eventually that if-and-then curiosity and deep observation and experimentation gave the world its first ever musical instrument. We can't ever know who that person was, but we do know that the kind of systemized thinking they were using is something autistic brains tend to excel at. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Simon Baron-Cohen is professor of developmental psychopathology and director of the Autism Research Center at the University of Cambridge. In his most recent book, The Pattern Seekers: How Autism Drives Human Invention, he explains how the systemizing mechanism works, how that kind of thinking contributes to society, and why autism ought to be understood as more than just a source of disability. Simon, welcome back to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
You open this book with the story of a little boy named Al, whose mom worried about him when he was a kid because he was not like a lot of the other children. What made Al seem different?
So we hear about this child, Al, who has trouble fitting in at school. His teachers think that he isn't intellectually capable, so he loses his kind of self-esteem. He becomes frustrated, doesn't want to attend school. And his mother, I think, did the right thing, which is decided to take her child out of school and to allow him to really pursue his interests at home. So kind of homeschooling, because this was a child who really had unstoppable curiosity. He loved to be experimenting with things at home, particularly his chemistry set. You started, this piece by describing somebody experimenting with a musical instrument. Well, Al was experimenting with everything he could find, but he just didn't fit into conventional education. So it turns out, we learn later in the book, The Pattern Seekers, that Al was actually Thomas Edison, the inventor of the first electric light bulb. And of course, he had hundreds of other patents on inventions he came up with. He was an example of somebody who just couldn't stop experimenting. He had a mind that, as you mentioned, liked to do little experiments which involve if and then. You know, if I take something and I do something to it, then let's see what happens. And that's what I've argued is kind of characteristic of people on the autism spectrum. They love looking for these if and then patterns, but it's also the mechanism in the brain, the systemizing mechanism, that drove invention in human evolution.
You don't claim in the book to know for sure whether Thomas Edison was on the autism spectrum, but you've learned through many years of research that autistic people are hyper-systemizers. How does that make them different from most people who are not on the spectrum?
Yeah. So obviously with Edison, we can't really go back into history to see whether he needed a diagnosis of autism. But what we can do is, as a researcher, we can look at people who are autistic today. We've done some big studies. One of them I might mention, which was an online study, where we asked people to take a survey, a questionnaire, to see how strong their interests are in patterns and in systems. It's called the Systemizing Quotient, or the SQ. We actually had 36,000 autistic people who logged in to take this test. And we had 600,000 people who were not autistic also online to take the test. And the autistic people score much higher, significantly higher than the non-autistic people. So this is giving us a clue that autistic people love systems, are strongly interested in systems, even more so than non-autistic people. But coming back to your question, we also found that if you just look in the general population, so that was the 600,000 people who took the test, and divide them into those who work in STEM, science, technology, engineering, or math, and those who do not work in STEM, the people who work in STEM not only have higher systemizing scores, but they also have more autistic traits. We invited them to take a second measure, which measures how many autistic traits a person has. So what we can see is that there's a connection between people who are good at systemizing in the general population and autistic people. Obviously, not everyone who is a strong systemizer is autistic or needs an autism diagnosis, but there's certainly a connection there between being a pattern seeker and being autistic. The only reason somebody would need an autism diagnosis, in my view, is if the high number of autistic traits they have are beginning to interfere with their quality of life and their ability to live independently and function. But otherwise, we see this kind of interesting, unexpected connection between autism and the capacity, the aptitude at understanding systems.
What are the steps involved in systemized thinking?
Yeah, so I've talked about this algorithm, if and then. And when engineers think about a system, they sometimes use different language, different terminology. They might talk about input, operation, output. But it's the same thing. It maps onto the same thing. So you take an input, could be anything at all. In the example you gave at the beginning of the program, it was blowing down a hollow bone. And then you do something to that input. In the example you gave, it was covering or uncovering a hole in the bone. And then you get the output. You listen to see how the sound is changing as you blow down the bone and either cover or uncover the hole. And, you know, the example, I think it was a very beautiful example because it's actually a real example from archaeology, that 40,000 years ago, one of our ancestors was experimenting with a system in that way to create the earliest musical instrument that's ever been found. The bone was as big as your little finger, and it was a hollow bone from a bird. But I think this is what characterizes one aspect of what's unique about the human mind, the human brain, is that we experiment. But we don't just experiment once. We experiment generatively. We look for these patterns and we invent generatively. That means over and over again in different ways.
So is this something all humans are capable of, but maybe some are more naturally inclined to than others?
Absolutely. So, you know, when we did that big study of 600,000 people, you know, we find everyone is interested to some level, to some degree, in patterns and systems, but some people are way above average. You know, we call them hypersystemizers. Autistic people tend to be in that group, but there are many people in that group. And it just means they've got a natural, you know, attraction to systems. If we come back to the case of autistic kids, what you might see if you have a young autistic child is they become fascinated by light switches in the house. So they're running around the house, putting different light switches into the on or off position to see what happens, to see whether this particular switch not only controls the light upstairs, but also controls maybe the light in the hallway downstairs. They're doing little experiments, and sometimes they get very upset if somebody interrupts their little experiments. They might do the same with water faucets, you know, turning on the faucet to different levels from low to high, and then rushing outside to see how the water is flowing out of the drain pipe in the front of the house. You know, they're trying to understand, on the one hand, you know, electrical systems that like the lights, or you know, the water systems, fluid dynamics in the case of faucets, or what we call in the UK the tap. But they're not doing this because they've, you know, been told to do it again. You know, they're doing it because they have a strong interest, and it's almost like they can't stop themselves doing this. Is their natural interest.
So for understanding social interactions, we often need empathy. How does the empathy circuit work differently from the systemizing mechanism?
Yeah, so if you try to systemize people and the social world, you can do it to a limited degree, but systemizing doesn't really allow you to really make sense of the complexity of the social world. So you can systemize something like, let's say, choreography in dance, where you have a pattern that's going to repeat. That would be an example. Or, you know, what an army might do if it's marching in a particular direction, you could try and systemize that. But if you take a conversation or a relationship, often there aren't patterns that you can observe, not repeating patterns that you can observe. So instead, what we use is a different mechanism in the brain, which I call the empathy circuit, which allows you to imagine somebody else's thoughts and feelings, to put yourself into someone else's shoes and take their perspective. And that way you can adapt very flexibly in a conversation. You can adapt very flexibly in a one-to-one interaction, in a relationship, as you notice that somebody, for example, might be upset or offended or distressed or joyful. You can sort of, on the, you know, as the relationship is unfolding, you can rapidly respond with an appropriate emotion to what the other person is thinking or feeling.
We lay people throw the word empathy around as if it's just one thing, but there are actually at least two forms that can shape how we relate to people. If cognitive empathy is the ability to imagine what another person might be thinking or feeling, what is affective empathy?
Yeah, so affective empathy is the response element. So once you've identified what someone else is thinking or feeling, that's the cognitive bit. The affective response is having an appropriate emotion to some in response to what someone is thinking or feeling. So let's take the example of that you identify that somebody is in pain. That's the recognition element, the cognitive element. The appropriate emotional response would be wanting to alleviate their distress. So you may it may trigger a desire to rush over and help, or it may trigger some sympathy, you know, something that will maybe reduce the person's distress. If we take the case of, say, a psychopath, the distinction between these two types of empathy becomes clearer, because the psychopath can recognize what someone is thinking or feeling. They can see that their victim is in pain, but they don't have the appropriate emotional response of caring about the person and wanting to reduce their suffering. Actually, they often do the opposite and torture them in some way. So this is where we see the disconnect between two different types of empathy. When it comes to autistic people, very interestingly, they are the mirror opposite of psychopaths. So they struggle with cognitive empathy. For example, many of them struggle to read emotions on people's faces or in their tone of voice. But they don't have any difficulties with affective empathy. Once you tell an autistic person that somebody is suffering, autistic people want to help. They want to reduce other people's suffering. And often autistic people are very moral and stand up for victims. If there's somebody being bullied, for example, they'll stand up and speak up in defense of the victim. It's very important to make this distinction between the two types of empathy. Autistic people do have empathy when it comes to affective empathy, but they have a disability in cognitive empathy.
We should note there are lots of combinations of systemizing and empathy in different amounts that occur in people because these characteristics are distributed throughout the human population in bell curves, right? Is there some reason why we wouldn't have all evolved to have equal amounts of ability in both of these areas?
Yeah, so I'm glad you've mentioned the bell curve, because what we found in that big study of 600,000 people in the general population is that in the case of empathy, we also had a measure of that, the EQ, the empathy quotient, and also in the case of systemizing, on the SQ, people fall on a bell curve. So most of us are in the average range. Some people are below average and some people are way above average. And what we find is that there are different types in the population. So we call these brain types, that some people lean more towards empathy. We call them type E. Some people lean more towards systemizing, so we call them type S. Some people sort of have a balanced brain. They're equally good at empathy and at systemizing, so we call them type B. And then there are the extremes, people who systemize nonstop, so extreme of type S, and also people who empathize nonstop, and we call them type E, extreme type E. And what, as you pointed out, these different types in the population, they're not kind of random. More people seem to either go towards one direction or the other. They're either leaning towards systems thinking or leaning towards empathy. We don't tend to see the majority of people in the middle in that balanced profile. And I think it's probably because both empathy and systemizing have a partly genetic basis, and evolution may have selected for individuals who specialize in one direction or another, that there are adaptive advantages to being either good at one or good at the other.
You mentioned genetics a while ago. Are the particular genes associated with hypersystemizing thinking also genes associated with someone being diagnosed on the autism spectrum?
Yes, so in my book, the Pattern Seekers, I talk about a research project we were fortunate enough to be able to conduct. Because when we asked people to take those questionnaires measuring how strong their interests are in systems, we also were able to work with a company called 23andMe. Some of your listeners will know about this company. It's a personal genomics company where you pay, I don't know, about $100, and you can find out what genes you're carrying. And their customers took that test, that systemizing test. So it gave us a chance to see whether systemizing or pattern seeking has a partly genetic basis. It turns out it does. But then we could go one step further and look to see if there was any overlap between they're called common genetic variants, genes that we all carry, which are associated with systemizing, and the common genetic variants associated with autism. And we found there was a significant overlap. So what that means is some of the genes that are associated with autism are also associated with good pattern recognition and understanding systems. And when we got this result, we published it, but in a scientific journal. But to my mind, this was the first strong evidence that we should change for changing our way that we think about autism, because the genes that were associated with autism were also associated with strengths and even talents.
Do you feel like there's too much of a focus? There are some difficulties that come with being on the autism spectrum for many people, but many people also don't want to change themselves. Do you think we focus too much on autism as a disability and not enough on the good things that may come along with this?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we need to look at autistic people through many different lenses. If they want a diagnosis, it's probably because they need support, that they're struggling. So we should see it through the lens of disability. But autism isn't just a disability. It's also a difference. And these days, there's a lot of talk about neurodiversity, the fact that there are many different ways for the brain to develop, that we all have strengths and challenges, that one kind of brain isn't better or worse than another. Just as we were saying, one species isn't better or worse than another. So even within humans, we should recognize diversity, celebrate diversity, and work towards making our society more inclusive of people who are different. Just because somebody, for example, doesn't want to socialize as much or may struggle with socializing, doesn't mean that they couldn't contribute in the workplace, that they couldn't benefit from being included in the educational system. And we need to make reasonable adjustments or accommodations, both at work, in education, and in wider society, so that people who think differently are not excluded.
Looking for patterns in the world requires the use of our external senses, right? I wonder if you think there's a relationship between pattern seeking, thinking, and behavior, and the tendency that some people on the autism spectrum have to struggle with sensory overload.
Yeah, I think this needs more research, but I think there could well be a connection. So when you systemize, when you look for these if and then patterns, the details matter. You have to look at all the small details, otherwise the system might not work. If we think about a mathematical system, you know, if you change one number in an equation, the equation comes out different or may not work. And in the case of music, you know, if you play one wrong note, it may be out of key. So the little details matter. In the case of a machine, you know, if all the component parts inside the machine are not working efficiently, then the machine may just grind to a halt. So autistic people, it's been very well established, have excellent attention to detail. They notice little things that other people may miss. And the question is, is that also giving rise to their sensory hypersensitivity? You know, some autistic people, the majority of autistic people report sensory hypersensitivity, that it really matters to them about the texture of their food, the feel of the clothes against their skin, you know, tiny details that other people might just be able to live with make a big difference to an autistic person. Some autistic people struggle with what's called information overload, that they're looking at so much detail that they find it difficult to, you know, identify what is relevant and what is irrelevant, what is important to focus on and what isn't. And that can leave them in a state of almost paralysis at times. So, you know, there are clear benefits to being a strong systemizer. We've talked a bit about those. Could give rise to remarkable talents in music and mathematics and even cooking, whatever it is that involves patterns. But there might be some downsides too.
Because of the way the world is set up, we sort of require autistic people, these strong systemizers, to live in environments set up for people who are not such strong systemizers. I wonder if there are ways that people who don't struggle with any kind of empathy could be better at getting a sense of what it's like, what it feels like to have a systemizing brain.
Now that's a really great question. I think really what you're asking is, could the rest of us, non-autistic people, show more empathy towards autistic people? What must it be like to be in a world that's been designed for the majority? Let's say autism is 1 or 2% of the population. Well, it turns out inadvertently that we've designed the school system, we've designed the workplace, we've designed society to work for the majority, for people who do have social skills and good communication. And what must it be like if you're in the 1 or 2% who finds it hard to keep up in class if the teaching is all based in groups and teams and communication? And if you're the 1 or 2% who prefers to learn in a different way, maybe from books or in a solitary way, or doing little experiments so you can really understand things from first principles. And also when it comes to the world of employment, we've created systems where we interview applicants for jobs and we look at the applicants based on their social skills. Can they make eye contact during the interview? Do we think they would be a good team player? Can they read the room as they come into the interview? These are all the things that autistic people struggle with. It's almost like we've created recruitment and employment processes that inadvertently discriminate against people with a disability in those areas. So maybe it's no wonder that the majority of autistic adults are unemployed. They're not making it through the interviews. Even though they may have the technical, systematic skills to be able to do the job. And we know that once you're unemployed, it's very bad for your mental health. And we find autistic adults have very high rates of depression and anxiety and even suicidality.
So we talked, Simon, at the beginning of this conversation about the hyper systemizer who was known as Al as a boy, later known to the world as Thomas Edison. Things worked out okay for him. You also write in this book about somebody named Jonah, whose brain seems to work in similar ways to Edison's, but who, as you've just alluded to, has struggled to even find a job despite having some skills that would unquestionably be an asset to employers. Tell us about Jonah.
Yeah, so Jonah was another little child that we meet in chapter 1 of the book. He isn't he's late to develop language, so his mother is getting a little bit anxious. Compared to other kids, he seems to be kind of delayed in the development of speech. Most kids are saying their first words by 12 months old, maybe 18 months old at the latest. He wasn't speaking till his second birthday. He also had, as he grew up, he clearly had a fascination with systems and patterns in the world. So in the playground at school, he didn't really mix with other kids, but he would collect different types of leaves from trees that had fallen on the ground so that he could understand all the different types of trees and leaves in the natural world in order to classify them. He was looking at all those patterns in the veins in leaves. And obviously, one of his teachers spotted that this is a child who's just a natural observer of nature, showing his talent and potential. As he got older, he could also listen to car engines. And just by the sound of the car engine, he could hear what was wrong with the engine and how the engine could be tuned to improve the efficiency of the engine or to prevent something going wrong. And so people would lend him their cars so that he could tune the engine just from the sound. And he knew, for example, when he went fishing, where to fish just by looking at the surface of the water, because it creates different patterns on the surface of the water, which indicates that there's a shoal of fish just underneath. So he was using his pattern recognition to help the local fishermen. But despite all these obvious talents, when he was writing job applications, he never really received any interviews or replies. And after sending in hundreds of job applications, he just became demoralized, living with his parents, not able to live independently, not able to earn a living, to have autonomy that comes through having a job and having an income. So developing depression and feeling excluded from society. And I think Jonah, you know, he illustrates that there is remarkable potential amongst autistic people, but for many of them, it's not being fulfilled. And the terrible, tragic waste of lives that we see amongst the autistic community, of people who could be contributing and could be enjoying good mental health, well-being, and yet instead, our society seems to be creating poor mental health in this group at really alarming rates.
What could schools do to better integrate the minds and the skills of hyper-systemizers, including students on the autism spectrum?
Yeah, so I think the first step is that schools may need to move away from this idea that a single method of education is going to be good for all kids. Clearly, many autistic kids are not enjoying the experience of going to school. Many of them not only get bullied for being different, which is to do with the stigma towards autistic kids that exists in society, but also they're not able to learn in a noisy, sociable environment. So they need, you know, so schools need to offer different, if you like, teaching environments for different kinds of kids. And of course, this is going to have a cost implication, but if you set that against the fact that autistic kids often drop out of high school, underachieving, maybe ending up unemployed and with poor mental health, as we've talked about, you know, there's a cost later to society further down the line. If we could be making adjustments, even at the earliest stage of, you know, when kids start school at the age of 4 years old, but then right through their school career, we could be creating autistic children and adults who are happy, who are getting the benefit of an education, and who can go on to contribute to society. Things have to change at the earliest point, which is absolutely right, in schools.
Simon Baron-Cohen is professor of developmental psychopathology and director of the Autism Research Center at the University of Cambridge. His most recent book is The Pattern Seekers: How Autism Drives Human Invention. Simon, this has been really fascinating. Thanks very much for taking time to talk.
I appreciate your interest. Nice to talk to you again.
Thank you. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram by searching for KERA Think, or do that same search wherever you get podcasts, and then you can subscribe to ours. It's free. You can also listen to the podcast at our website and sign up there for the Think e-newsletter. That is think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.